If the committee would come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. It is Tuesday, the 31st of January, approximately 3:30 in the afternoon. We have Senator Elton Wagner, myself, Senator Terrio, and Senator Betty Davis. So we do have a quorum. I believe that Senator Huggins will be joining us shortly. I thought that we would first take up the issue of the confirmation for Commissioner Corbis as the Lieutenant Governor Designee so that he can get back to other business fairly quickly. So, Mr. Corbis, if you'd like to come forward. And our committee members have handed out a packet here that deals with a little bit of background for the commissioner and then also the constitutional language and the statutory language that talks about a designee. When this when your name appeared on the list, it kind of caught me by surprise. I think I'm not sure how many years we'd gone without taking the step, I think, of making the official, you know, designee known or taking action on it. So with that, perhaps you can give us just a little bit of information on why things have played out the way they have this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if I could first make just a brief opening statement. My name is Bill Corbis, Commissioner of Revenue. I've served in that capacity since December 16, 2002. I came to Alaska in 1970 and immediately went to work for the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company, which is the largest investor-owned electric utility in the state. I spent most of my time there as general manager and retired in August of 2002. During that period, I also served approximately 25 years on three different bank board of directors and have been active in civic affairs, such organizations as the State Chamber of Commerce, various state and municipal boards and commissions, and working with various nonprofit organizations trying to address some of our social problems. I retired, as I say, in August of 2002. In December, the governor asked me to come to work for him as Commissioner of Revenue, which I was pleased to accept because I wanted to help him make the state a better place for all of us to live. Similarly, I'm willing to accept this contingent responsibility as the successor to the Lieutenant Governor under AS 44-19040. In answer to the chairman's question, I don't know why the administration submitted my name, nor why it was not done sooner. And I'd be available to answer any questions.
Okay. So the we've got the constitutional language here, appointment, and then the statutory stuff. Fairly straightforward. Person designated and confirmed is next in line. So do members have any questions on the commissioner's number one qualifications or any questions on the statutory framework here?
I already met with the gentleman once today, Mr. Chairman.
I heard he was making the rounds. So. Okay. So, Heather, do we have the letter then for the... okay. Then what, Senator Elton?
Not a question. I just was waiting to see if anybody else had a question. I've not known Bill since he first got here in 1970. I think I missed the first couple of years. But I can tell you that from my experience, whether we've agreed or not agreed, I can can't think of a better person to be in the line of succession, and I think it'd be tragic if he did accede to the office, but not because of his qualifications, but simply because of something that may have happened to somebody else. So I as a general statement, I just, having known him as a member of the community, having known him as somebody who is close to the Taku River, having known him as somebody who has been part of our business community for such a long time, I can't imagine a better person.
Thank you, Senator Elton.
Senator Wagner.
Well, the one question I would have, and I don't know how it would be handled, but if something did happen at this stage of, for instance, pipeline negotiations, you're very deeply involved in the negotiations on the gas pipeline. Do you feel comfortable that you could still have an influence on the gas pipeline process, the negotiations, as well as switch over to Lieutenant Governor if something were to take place just instantaneously?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, the gas pipeline negotiations have been very much part of my life for the last couple of years, and I must admit I would find it hard to completely get away from that. I would hope that I would still be able to contribute to that process. You know, the Lieutenant Governor's office is right next door to the Governor's office.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other question? Seeing none, then we just need a motion to report the name to the full legislature or full Senate.
I would move that we forward William Corbis's name to the full body of the Senate for confirmation.
Seeing no objection, then we will report the name. Thank you, for Commissioner, for coming in. And if we could just take a brief at ease. Next, we'd like to go to a presentation from the Chief Administrative Law Judge, Ms. Terry Thurbin, on her operations. Trying to monitor the, number one, the caseload that you and your staff are trying to deal with, the way that the agencies hopefully have embraced the new operation, and we're seeing the wisdom in transitioning over to have administrative hearings handled by your staff.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Terry Thurbin, the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings, which I'm sure most all of you will recall was created under Senate Bill 203 that took effect in 2004. Was adopted in 2004, and many of the provisions were actually had a delayed effective date of July 1st, 2005. We've just finished our first full calendar year of operating together. Half of that calendar year was spent in a transitional phase where we were focused mainly on work that transferred in with the employees who were brought over from the various hearing units in Departments of Revenue, Commerce, and Department of Administration. Then the second half of this calendar year, the first half of fiscal year 06, from July 1st and forward, we've had our full jurisdiction, and as a consequence, the caseload has expanded and has reached into other categories that we hadn't had occasion to work on in the first 6 months. So I wouldn't at this point consider this a typical year, but I think it is a good sort of benchmark of where we're likely to see the activities go in the future. Also, because it was our startup year, I'm sort of sad to report that I don't feel like we made as much progress as I optimistically predicted last year we would make on the non-hearing related functions. We spent most of our time during our first year together dealing with adjusting to the new caseload, dealing with the high volume of cases, and so the what I'll call the ancillary functions, the training, the monitoring other agencies' hearing functions, the publishing of decisions from our own and other agencies, and some of those other ancillary functions. I was much too optimistic last year in the first annual report when I was before this committee in predicting how far we would get on those functions, but I'm very proud of what we've been able to do on the caseload so far. We handled, and I think you should have three handouts before you, and two of them, and the first one I'm going to talk from that's titled OAH Case Resolution Data for 2005 is a table that's also reproduced in the annual report that was delivered this morning. The second one, the color graph, I'll speak to briefly. That's also in the report. And then the third handout on the hours is not in the report, but we may speak a little bit about the hours we've devoted to the various departments and sub-agencies' cases. We handled essentially 1,271 cases this year. We touched them in some form or fashion. Some of those transferred in at the beginning of our time together without much work left to be done on them, a few just because the appeal period hadn't run. So I don't want to represent that we've done a significant amount of work on every single one of those 1,271 cases, but we transferred in 321 the first of the year and added 950 new cases during the course of the calendar year. The cases came in at the rate of 79 a month on average throughout the course of the year. And if anybody's worried that that was a fluke and it's not going to continue, I can tell you as of noon today, we've had 82 new cases this month alone in calendar year 06. So I think we can safely predict that the work is going to be there for the foreseeable future. Of the 1,271 cases that we had, we managed to close 75.5% of them, 960 cases. About 12.4% of those we managed to resolve on motions, on procedural processes, short of actually having to have a full-blown evidentiary hearing and issue a significant decision. 42 were resolved by what I would consider a traditional settlement, a true negotiated settlement between the parties, as opposed to some of the other, what you might think of as alternative dispute resolution efforts, where we might reach a consensual agreement on the record with the parties during or prior to a hearing. We don't count those as a settlement, and that's why the settlement category doesn't sound as large as it might otherwise be. But that's about 3.3% of the cases were resolved by settlement. I was surprised, actually, when I sat down to put together the statistics for the annual report to find that only in 21 of the cases had any of the parties requested that the final decision maker either reconsider a decision that we'd issued if we had the, if we were in the pre-July 1 phase where we were issuing final decisions, or in the post-July 1 phase under some of the new procedures that Senate Bill 203 brought to us, the parties have an opportunity to ask for the final decision maker to do something different than we're recommending before the decision actually goes final. And in those two categories, what I'll call reconsideration slash proposed action, we had only 21 cases where somebody asked for a different result. I don't know that that means that everybody's really happy with the decisions. It's just that sometimes the problem is not with the decision we make so much as with the law or the facts that didn't support the party's position. Similar number, 21 also, but not the same exact 21 cases have gone up on appeal. When I say have gone up on appeal, 15 of those are cases that predate OAH's time. They are cases that were already working their way through the administrative adjudication process, and some had already been appealed to court long before we merged last January 1st. So we are carrying those open on our books as cases to follow while we're waiting to see what the court system does with those. So only six of these actually, if I might say, happened on our watch. And of the ones that have gone up on appeal of that total number of 21, the biggest chunk is from the professional licensing category. It's kind of understandable. There's a lot at stake with professionals who are being disciplined or who are trying to get a license of some kind and they're being denied. There have been a small chunk of cases that have gone up on appeal from the sort of the tobacco vendor business arena in Alaska, bringing constitutional or statutory challenges to the scheme of regulating and enforcing the tobacco sales laws, sales to minors, and that sort of thing. And so those are not necessarily indicative of a problem with the hearing process or even with the Department of Commerce's approach to the enforcement, but those are targeted at issues with the law. And so you may hear more about that in another venue, I suppose. A couple of them were child support cases. I think three were contract and procurement cases, and a handful of other cases have gone up on appeal. And of those, a few have trickled back to us, again, mostly that predated our time together, with kind of a mix of results. We've had some where the case has been remanded back to the executive branch agency, or in some instances directly to us for some sort of a supplemental hearing, or to revisit the record and more clearly articulate the reason for the finding. But that, off the top of my head, I'd say that's four or five cases that we've had that have come back to us, and the rest of those that have gone up on appeal are still out there in some status waiting resolution, or they were affirmed on appeal and there's nothing more for us to do. And it's just a matter of that's a recent development. We need to close those on our books. So that leaves us with 311 cases that we transferred over at the first of the year for this calendar year that we're continuing to work on. And I think that's going to be about typical. 25% or so of the cases equates with the cases that are opened in the last 2, 3, 4 months of the year are still going to need some work going forward in the next calendar year. So I think on the whole, these numbers are a pretty good indication that we're keeping up with the cases in a pretty reasonable fashion. I'd like to get that a little tighter and get it down to where we only have 20% or so of the cases that we're carrying over from one year to the next, but a lot of it is driven by when they come in. And that's sort of what I wanted to illustrate with the sort of the colored graph here, the bar chart, is that we don't have any control over when the cases come in, with the exception of voluntary referrals, and I'll talk a little bit more about voluntary referrals in a minute. We have to take them as they come in the door, and as this graph indicates, we have all kinds of spikes in the referrals. Last January was a big month, as was July. And then we also have spikes within any given month. This month, for example, 82 cases. We had a few days where we got none. Yesterday, I had 16 that hit my desk that I had to make a case assignments on. Today, we got 4 more already. By the close of business today, we may have even more waiting back at the office. So we don't really have any control at the rate over which the cases come to us, and we just have to try to adapt to make our operation take those cases, absorb them, get them assigned, get them working, and try to get them done within the statutory time frames. Another thing that we have worked on very hard this year is to try to reconcile the timelines for the cases. The Senate Bill 203 created a very specific process that's meant to have most of the cases resolved within, or at least to the proposed decision stage, within 120 days after a party requests a hearing. And so far, I think that's working okay. There are certainly cases that are not going to be resolvable in that time period, and there are a lot of others that we can do quicker than that. But that has been working out fine. That's not all of the cases that we deal with, however. There are some cases that were exempted from that timeline for good reasons, and there are still cases working their way through the process that occurred before, that arose before the July 1st, 2005 date at which those deadlines kicked in. So we are kind of constantly juggling how do we keep all the cases on track to meet their various deadlines, which deadlines apply. And we found that there's a big chunk of the work that we do that actually has tighter deadlines under other statutes or regulations than that 120-day track. And sometimes we find that those cases that we consider the fast-track cases, it feels to us like they're taking away time from the cases that we should be trying to get done in the other categories as well. And so it's a fine balancing act. But on the whole, I think we're doing okay. Because somewhere in the report you'll see, when you had a chance to read it, that as to that 120-day clock and the cases that have been subject to that since July 1st, we've only missed the mark in 37 cases. And again, I wish it were only 3 or 4 cases instead of 37, but 37 out of a few hundred that have been subject to those deadlines is not too bad, considering that in the meantime we've got a lot of other cases still backed up that are working their way through under slower time frames because they predated July 1st, 2005. So that's kind of in generalities the caseload information. Now, the way that it breaks out as far as how much work we're doing for the various departments, that's why I included the additional handout, which is something that I prepared for our friends over at OMB so they could get a sense of where we're spending our time and who's paying the bill. We do the biggest majority of our cases by number and by hour for the Department of Revenue, and that's not surprising. They transfer to us a five-person hearing unit, three administrative law judges, two support staff. Half of our group, I should say, comes from the Department of Revenue, and they brought with them what we call the high-volume docket. The child support cases, which numbered over 500 this year, the permanent fund eligibility cases, which numbered 264, I think. And that's pretty typical. Those are the numbers that revenue has seen for the last few years, about somewhere in the 700 to 800 case for those two parts of the docket combined. So I think that's probably going to be constant. It may ebb and flow as to whether permanent funds are higher or child supports are higher, but I think we can pretty much reliably count on always having 700 or 800 cases, and the challenge is going to be to try to find ways to resolve them more expeditiously, faster for the parties, and more cost-effective for the state. And we're working on that. The next biggest chunk of our casework comes from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and it's not a high number of cases in number. It's only about 148, I think, total cases since we've been together, but it adds up to a lot of hours because those tend to be the more complex cases. Not all of them, but some. Doctor licensing, dentist licensing, even some of the business licensing, like the tobacco endorsement cases I mentioned earlier. Those kinds of cases tend to be the ones where the parties do a lot of work before the hearing, perhaps filing motions and asking for rulings in advance of the hearing. And also then they need multiple days, sometimes multiple weeks of hearings. And then with that volume of information and evidence to deal with, necessarily the decision writing takes more time, more hours. So as a consequence, it works out that the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development may only contribute about 1/8 as many cases by number as the Department of Revenue, but we can do the revenue cases for about 2.5 times as many hours as it takes to do the commerce docket. And then the rest of the cases come from a variety of places. We have a fair chunk from Department of Administration, if you count in that category, the tax cases that really belong to us uniquely. We are the successor agency to the Office of Tax Appeals. It's the one and only category of cases that's considered an original jurisdiction case, where the parties file directly with us, and we work the case under some statutory provisions, mostly exempt from the requirements of Senate Bill 203 with some exceptions. We finish those cases and the parties go straight to court if they disagree. That's the only category of cases that's like that. From the Department of Administration, though, we also get contract and procurement cases. We do the violent crime compensation claim cases for that board. And we are now doing the retirement and benefits cases as a result of Senate Bill 141 last year. So we have quite a slug of cases from Department of Administration divisions or from our own tax function. But even that doesn't equal either the two major contributors, Department of Revenue and Department of Commerce. And then there's everybody else. And Senate Bill 203 added a whole lot of things that the people who transferred together last January from Revenue and Administration and Commerce had never had occasion to work on. Facilities licensing for DHSS, we're doing foster care facilities, child care facilities, assisted living facilities. That's just what they're required to send to us. On the other side of things, in terms of voluntary referrals, once the agencies realize we are out there and we're set up and all it takes is a phone call and a few pieces of paper to refer a case to us and they don't have to go through a procurement process, an appointment process to hire a contract hearing officer, they started referring cases to us voluntarily. So for DHSS, for example, we handled a few of their public benefits-like cases that they couldn't handle in-house due to overload or conflicts. That was the early days. Well, most recently we've had now, I think just in the last 2 weeks, we've had four new voluntary referrals of significant cases from them that are going to take large hours investments that otherwise they would have if they didn't want to do it in-house with a non-hearing person, non-attorney person designated to function as a hearing officer. They would have had to contract with a private attorney to do those cases. We've had voluntary referrals from the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Natural Resources, neither of which are required to bring us their cases until 2007, but they went ahead and jumped in and started very early on. and there haven't been a lot of cases from them, but we've done some work for them. In the Department of Education category, the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, they were required under Senate Bill 203 to bring us their permanent fund execution cases. That's the program where they can administratively go after somebody's permanent fund dividend to satisfy a student loan without having to go to court and get a judgment from the court. Well, they had to bring us those, and once they decided they were going to be working with us on those, they decided they would bring us their medical cancellation of student loan cases, so that if somebody is trying to get their student loan canceled due to a medical disability, we're doing the hearings for them now. It's not a huge number of cases, but it's a lot more efficient for them to call us up and say, we've got some more voluntary referrals, send us a few pieces of paper, and we've got the parties within a week, we've got them before us for a pre-hearing conference to organize how the process will go, and we can get moving on it a lot faster than they could have rounded up a contract hearing officer. Who else have we gotten voluntary referrals from? Those are the ones that stand out, except within the departments that are our, what you might call our main feeders of work.
Can I interject something?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm pretty familiar with post-secondary. We used to handle the appeals as a commission, and it didn't seem like we had that many appeals. And you say it's more efficient for them to come through your office now instead of handling that appeal case by case on the medical?
Well, Senator Wagner, through the chair, my understanding is at least the ones that are being referred to us are cases that the commission has delegated to the executive director to handle herself. So instead of that staff person functioning as the hearing person, they had been contracting out to a private attorney hearing officer to do those, and now they're having us do those.
Okay.
There may be some other category of medical cancellation cases, bigger loan amounts at stake or something else that are still going back to the commission, and I'm just not aware of those.
Yeah. A lot of them go up into the thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, I'll talk to them about it. Thanks.
In terms of the other voluntary referrals, from the departments that are required to send us certain categories of cases, we're getting voluntary referrals as well. We provided an administrative law judge to work with the State Assessment Review Board on the TAPS valuation appeal last year. It was a significant piece of work, and we expect that to the extent there are future State Assessment Review Board processes, appeals from year to year, that will provide that function as well. We've got a few voluntary referrals from the Department of Commerce that are rate cases that were exempted under SB 203 from our jurisdiction, but they needed somebody to hear them, and so we're doing those as well. And then to show the fullest extent of our use of the various Senate Bill 203 powers that you gave us, we have had our first occasion to use the General Reimbursable Services Agreement authority that you put in the law that says, If the law otherwise allows a government entity to send us a case, we can take it on a reimbursable services agreement basis. And we took a case for the court system. It was a small procurement case. They had to have it done in a hurry under their own procurement guidelines. And it just so happened that they called at a time when we had somebody who was available that we could have turned to it right away, and they didn't have to go through a process to contract with a private hearing officer. We did the case for them. It's not going to cost them a fortune. It got done within the timelines, and it did not take us off track from our main work for one very important reason that I want to emphasize. It came to us at a time after we had only recently filled the vacancy that was created when the PERS-TERS legislation last year authorized us to add one more administrative law judge. If it had come 2 months earlier, or even just a few days before we had filled that position, we probably would not have had the capacity to take that because we were really pushing the limits of our ability to keep up with the caseload. But because we added the capacity by filling that position, and that person just hadn't been with us long enough to have a really full case list yet, we were able to take that case, and that's true of some of the DHSS voluntary referrals. And my point that I want to stress on that, and that I'm maybe getting outside of the main interest of this committee, is that the ability to build capacity to take additional cases is kind of key to the success of this operation, I believe, which is why we have in the fiscal year 07 budget asked for the budgetary authority to add an additional administrative law judge if the caseload truly justifies it. My intent will be only to fill that position if the caseload justifies it. Right now, we had capacity sort of built into the system by virtue of the chief's position. My position is, there's an awful lot of administrative duties and other ancillary duties, but I do hear cases as well. And the way we got through the first year, essentially, until we filled the one vacancy that was authorized, the new position that was authorized by the PERS legislation, is I started taking cases, and I took cases, and I took cases, and my people worked very hard. I'm very proud of how hard they stepped up, and they worked long hours, and that gets me sort of to the last of the three handouts. Back to the last of the three handouts. Collectively, on casework alone, doesn't include staying up and current with the law and other sort of professional development activities and keeping their time and dealing with administrative duties, the administrative law judges, and this is when we had five full-time plus my contribution of about quarter time on cases, we invested over 4,000 hours in hearings during the first 6 months of this fiscal year, and we're projecting it's going to be over 5,000 in the balance. And that has caused us to quite easily be able to collect, to charge the interagency receipts back to the agencies for whom we're doing the work. We did find that it was something of an adventure in fee setting under the cost allocation plan. We ended up with a large hourly fee, at least it was too large for my comfort, that we charged for the first 6 months of this fiscal year based on the cost allocation plan estimates of how hard we were going to work. We ended up working harder, having more work to do. The administrative law judges worked harder, more hours than I'd projected. And so it turns out that we've already collected between the bills for interagency receipts and the general fund money that we had that was dedicated to the Office of Tax Appeals function and some of the other case functions as well as the ancillary functions. We've already collected over or billed for over 70% of our budget amount. So we're going to be cutting our rate for the rest of the year. And we'll eventually hopefully come up with some equilibrium where we will come up with a rate that will stick throughout the course of a year that we won't be at risk of over collecting. And we'll be reasonable and hopefully we'll come down as much as it occasionally has to go up to deal with increasing costs, personnel costs and occupancy costs. We're hoping that the economies of scale as we have more caseload that justify adding more positions will keep that rate steady, if not bringing it down lower and lower. That's it on caseload, and unless there are any questions, and I can certainly talk about anything else in the report that you'd like. It seems to me that I've probably omitted some high points, but I think the caseload is the most interesting part of what we did this year.
I'm intrigued by the fact that maybe we can make bad agency decisions a profit center here somehow. Senator Wagner and then Senator
Elton. That
works
for me. I just was looking at your figures here, and the difference between your July through December 205 and the January projection from January to June 206 is about a half-time equivalent job, basically over 1,000 hours. So if you're projecting that throughout the year instead of just the 6 months, it looks to me like you're going to have another full-time position. Or can you absorb some of those hours in the structure you currently have?
Well, through the chair, Senator Wagner, the truth of the matter is this projection accounts for the fact that we now have filled that vacancy, that new position.
Okay.
We only got it filled in December, and it's the ability of that person now to contribute time. And in fact, that's the one thing that is allowing me to cut back a little bit on the cases I take, so I can try to get some traction on some of the ancillary functions. And so that is why we are able to do more hours in this. My initial projections that I did for OMB on this, and then I decided not to hand them in that way, showed that the number of hours that we might be able to put in on cases if the trends hold true, and that's always a big if, was a little higher than this. And then I pared it back to what was more realistic in terms of how many hours I can reasonably expect the employees to work. So we may end up with more than 5,000 hours billed for the last half of this fiscal year. It could come down the other way. This is one of the challenges of this exercise, both of the rate setting up and of the planning, not just for us, but for the agencies that have to plan and budget to pay for our services, is you never know whether that case I just talked to somebody about yesterday that we think might take 200 or 300 hours of administrative law judge time is really going to settle after we've only got 20 hours into it, or if it's really going to stretch out long enough that it's going to carry over into next fiscal year and we're only going to do 100 hours of that time this fiscal year. So it's sort of a fine dance that we're doing in terms of trying to project reasonably and plan accordingly for our own budget and for the, what I'll call the customer agencies. But so far, I think we're doing okay.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Terry, for your presentation. I'm trying to figure out, and you may have said it and I just missed it, but of the billable hours that you had in the first 6 months of the fiscal year, I mean, what percentage of that is in the category that you call voluntary, that you don't have to take?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I don't know a percentage. I haven't bothered to run that number, but off the top of my head, I would say that with the number of cases that we had and the types of cases they were, some were pretty simple and easily resolved, and others were of the more complex nature. I don't think I can give you a percentage, though I probably could go back and calculate one if you're interested. I'd be happy to do that. But it's probably no more than 10% of the 4,000 hours, I wouldn't think, is devoted to the voluntary referrals in this particular six-month period. Some of those voluntary referrals that show hours billed during that six-month period actually started at the end of FY05, and so the significant work was done then, and some of it carried over, and then some of it isn't finished yet, so it'll be showing up in this second half. So I don't think it's more than 10%, 400 hours.
That's close enough.
And it may be a little less than that.
Mr. Chair, so am I wrong in looking at the volunteer work as kind of your cushion, that if, in fact, you underestimated what the workload is going to be in the next 6 months, I mean, that's kind of a cushion for you. You can just say no to some of the voluntary stuff as you concentrate on the other stuff?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, it is certainly the thing we could do in terms of case management strategy, that if we can turn away the voluntary referrals. So it's a cushion in that regard. It gives us the ability to say we've got to stay focused on the mandatory referrals and get those done. So thank you. I'd love to do this for you, but I can't. We can turn them away. It also sort of provides a financial cushion, I think, insofar as if we can actually absorb the cases, put the hours on the books, and charge back those agencies, that should hopefully bring the rates down across the board for everybody. All things being equal. Now, there's a limit to how much I can expect any given administrative law judge to work, and my administrative law judges are all PX employees, and there's nobody who's punching a 7.5-hour clock day in and day out. I mean, everybody is stepping up, and if they've got if we're doing alternative dispute resolution, which we did not too long ago, a supervised negotiation for parties in a contract claim, and the administrative law judge has to stay till 8 or 9 o'clock that night to keep the parties' noses to the grindstone and get the case settled, he'll do it. We've had that happen. I think over time there's a limit to how much you can expect the folks to step up constantly before you have to make the cut. Either you turn the voluntary referrals away or you add staff.
Just one more quick question. Mm-hmm. On the voluntary referrals, do both parties or all parties have to agree to the referral, or is it an agency decision only?
Senator Elton, through the chair, it is an agency decision only in everyone that I can think of so far. It may very well be there is a type of case out there I'm not thinking of where the parties would have a particular standing to help select who the hearing officer is, in which case the agency might have to get their consent. I'm thinking, for example, these are not cases that come to us, but some of the cases that the Department of Transportation deals with under a law that was passed a couple, 3 years ago, they have a special, I want to say, arbitration sort of process that involves using a hearing officer from an agreed-upon list. If they were to start sending us those cases, which they don't have to do and they're not planning to, then the parties might have some say in whether it really could come to us or whether our administrative law judges could be on that list. But I can't think of any of the voluntary referrals we've gotten so far where it is anybody's decision other than the referring agency who they're going to go to get a hearing officer.
Thanks, Mr.
Terry, just trying to be mindful. One of the things that, you know, we're trying to look for the efficiencies, and I think, you know, when the hearing officers were in the agencies, the person that is sending work to the hearing officer may be, you know, in the office in the corner, and the hearing officer was maybe in the cubicle, you know, next to the coffee pot. So there would be this feedback on the amount of cases that the department or division was creating and the ability to handle that workload. I'm hoping now that through through your billing back, that closing of the loop is still there, and that it's not just a, you know, yeah, maybe we're operating and we're causing these things to be challenged, but somebody else is handling that. I mean, is that bill back, you know, immediate enough, do you think, for the agencies to be mindful? How are we operating? How many cases are we triggering? Why is that happening? Can we modify our operations so the caseload comes down? Because we hoped over time that we would see better written regulations so everybody understands there's less to adjudicate, better decision-making within the agency so there's less to adjudicate. But I'm just wanting to check with you to see if you think that sort of feedback is still there through that ability to charge back.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, I think it is. It is, in fact, we had the experience of what you might call a holy cow moment for a lot of the agencies when they got the bills for the first half of this fiscal year, and that was in part because the rate had been set, as I explained earlier, too high based on unrealistic projections based on the data we had from our first few months of working together. And that's going to smooth out a little bit as we adjust our rate over the balance of the year. But they also had, I think, the experience of, at least what I'm hearing from the agencies, they had the experience of, my heavens, this function really is taking more hours than we appreciated. And we're seeing it now in an hourly rate bill back instead of it being absorbed in our, for example, our commissioner's office. Usually the hearing unit was associated with a commissioner's office because these were commissioner-level decisions or boards or commissions in the case of commerce. And I think this is only my speculation, but I think that the way that the various agencies dealt with paying for their hearing units had those commissioner's offices absorbing some of those costs, and so the agencies who were making the decisions that were being challenged, they weren't really seeing the cost consequences in their own budgets of those cases that went up, and so perhaps they weren't being as judicious as they could have been. And now that they're seeing it in hourly rate terms, I think that everything I've seen so far indicates that they want to try to work harder to come up with ways to minimize the cases coming to us that don't need to. Now, there are some cases they're always going to need to have a hearing. People have the right to have a hearing whether or not they really have the merits on their side. They certainly have a right to have a hearing if they think the agency has done something wrong and the agency has done something wrong that needs to be corrected. But we are working with especially the what you might call the most frequent customer agencies, the agencies that feed us the most work. We're working with them on a pretty regular basis to try to help them figure out how to not refer cases to us if they don't need to, if the cases can be resolved prior to coming to us, or if it is a case that really in Senate Bill 203 parlance, they can fairly issue a notice of denial of the hearing request because it really isn't a proper hearing request. And they are embracing the opportunity to do that, in part, I think, because the cost is now much more of a reality. The costs are not absorbed elsewhere or hidden from their view. They know how much this function is really costing them now.
Yeah. And it's not to say that you have any state employee out there just making bad decisions, purposefully making bad decisions. But, you know, if it stems from poorly written statute or regulations, you know, hopefully that comes to light, then that's the cause of the problem. That's what's causing us so much cost in this division, so we need to get that fixed. Or perhaps it is a particular employee that, geez, the number of, you know, her particular cases go up on appeal and they keep being overturned. Well, then we got to figure out what's wrong with, you know, that employee. Maybe there's training that needs to go on. So I'm hoping just that feedback through that cost structure is there, and that the economics of it dictate that the departments find out what's going on and see what they can do to correct it. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's absolutely a part of it. And another part of it is the training mandate that we were given under Senate Bill 203, and we've done some training. I don't mean to say we haven't made any progress on the ancillary functions, the non-hearing functions. We've done some training, especially regarding the changes in the procedures, and we're working with the agencies to develop other opportunities for training their adjudicators, which can even include not the people who appear before us, but the people who are essentially doing informal conference decisions or other sorts of hearing-related functions that then feed into our hearings to help them understand how to more effectively deal with the issues and resolve the cases that are meritorious, and then let the ones that are a closer call come on to us and be heard. So I think we've got an opportunity to help correct some of those problems there through the training process as well.
Okay, and then just a quick question. DEC, you mentioned that they have a delayed effective date as far as their stuff coming in, but you did have some utilization of your shop. DEC was extremely reluctant to participate. Are they having a little bit of a change of heart?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's absolutely the case, because the very first, I think, case that came in after we merged, voluntary referral case that came in right around the time we were merging last January was from DEC. And, you know, there are a number of factors, I believe, that come into play, but my understanding, and as some of the committee members may know, DEC was a client agency of mine when I was at the Department of Law, so I have a better understanding, I think, of what their hesitation was on whether this would work for them. I think that they now have a comfort level that their process of appeals, or what's called adjudicatory hearings, for their environmental permitting issues can fit within the scheme that was envisioned by Senate Bill 203. And I haven't had any bad reports or any indications that they're not going to send us more cases. There's no projections for them sending in a city for the next 6 months, just because I don't know whether there's anything in the pipe. But I fully expect that if they have something that they think they want to send to a hearing officer, they're going to come to us and not go to a private hearing officer until 2007, when they're required to start coming to us. They just don't have a huge quantity of cases year in and year out.
Okay, and then I see Appendix A here, survey results. Are you going to put out, a regular survey for all parties involved in the hearings, that we're going to see results build up?
Yes.
And reported on a yearly basis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have come up with a way to figure out how to survey a proportion of the hearing participants. Our protocol, if you will, is for all the what we call the low volume cases, the ones that we only have teens and hundreds of, that we will survey all the hearing participants. And then for the high volume cases, where we have more than 1,000 of those a year combined, or close to 1,000 of those a year combined, we're going to sort of randomly select every third case to survey the hearing participants. And then that's the data that will be reported. Now, that's how we're going to do it within our own shop. What I haven't quite come to terms with yet, and Senate Bill 203 contemplates this, is how we're going to come up with a way to do that with all the other agencies. That the surveying function was part of the overall monitor all agencies' hearing functions and see how it's going and what improvements could be made. And I just haven't really had the time to sit down with a lot of the other agencies that are not required to send their hearings to us, that have a substantial hearing function: Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Department of Labor for employment securities cases, DMV. There are a lot of folks out there that are doing hearings that we might want to try to get into this sweep of this survey process as part of the overall monitoring. And we haven't quite come to terms with how we're going to do that. But when we do, and we start surveying some portion of their hearing participants as well, and the data will be reported, it was just one of those functions that we didn't get organized in time this year to have data to report in the annual report.
Okay. Well, that was another thing looking for, is the sense on the general public that the person holding the hearing, adjudicating the appeal, is at least at arm's length from the department, and they're getting a fair shake. I mean, we want the public to feel like they had their day in court, and feel good about the process, whether they won or lost. So,
well, and Mr. Chairman, if I could just add on that point, we have when the new processes took effect starting July 1st, and the cases that were really subject to the new procedures, the new timelines, and that, we took the opportunity in our hearings to start getting people familiar with the fact that things have changed. We had, up until then, it was always the practice of the administrative law judges in the various hearing units to explain that, you know, they're doing an independent hearing on behalf of the Commissioner of Revenue, for example, and they're not there representing the permanent fund division or the child support services. They had always done that, but we did it in kind of a grander way in our hearings, in the early days at least, to make sure that people really understood that we are an independent entity now. We're not even part of that department anymore. We may be making a recommended decision to go to the Commissioner of Revenue or the State Medical Board or something, but we're not even part of that agency. And I think that this is only my observation, but I think that that message is going down well with the hearing participants, and they are less inclined now to believe that we're just an extension of the very same division that made the decision they don't like.
There's one other question. Language that was inserted last year. Reviewing applicants of persons interested in serving on the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and forwarding names to the governor. Is that duty kicked in?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Mr. Chairman, the current Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission that was just recently appointed was a result of the process of inviting the applications and screening them for qualification and forwarding the 14 names to the governor. And that is so that's a new function. It's one of my duties as chief, and I don't know whether to be pleased or sorry to say that it's going to be a recurring duty, because those positions are staggered, so that there will be one commissioner position expiring every year, so that they're not all expired at once. So I'm imagining I'm going to have to do some level of a sort of recruitment and preparation of a list and transmitting to the governor year in and year out, so we'll just make it part of our habit. And then the other function that we serve is I am the designated person to find a pro tem, a temporary chair, when the chair of that commission has conflicts or is away, extended leave for medical reasons. And we've had that happen once already, that the new chair had a conflict and we needed to provide a qualified person to serve as the chair. And it just so happens, fortunately, that right now we have a person in our shop that has sufficient workers' comp experience that we were able to simply provide a chairperson from our own group. We didn't have to go out and procure a workers' compensation practitioner to serve in that position. We may not always have that luxury, but we were able to do it this time.
Good. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
And finally, for the committee, we did get a draft of House Bill 83 back. And I'd like...
Mr. Chairman, just congratulations to you on your bill. It's working.
It seems like it's working pretty well. Thank you. So I'd like Heather to just run us through the changes in the CSC, if it encapsulates everything that we discussed the other day, and if so, we can possibly take final action on it. So what I have before me is dated 12606, and it is the / S as in Sam version.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Heather Brake, staff to Senator Terrio in the Senate State Affairs Committee. / S is the work draft that, as you mentioned, is before you. The first change is in Section 1. The drafter recommended that we remove on line 6, a member holds office until a successor is appointed. He felt that language was ambiguous, and in our conversations, he indicated that adding a section on page 2 to provide for the members who are already appointed to this commission, who all 9 of them expire on June 30th, 2006. So that section 5 then allows for staggered terms. It allows that any of the already appointed members may continue on the board, and that they also may be reappointed. Section 2, line 12, there was in your audit reports on page 10, the legislative auditor had recommended If the legislature, I'll just read for just a sentence or two here. If the legislature is considering continuation of the commission, we believe that a statutory revision or expansion to the commission membership should include at least three local government representatives from seismically different geographic areas of the state. House Bill 83, the version that came to us, did expand the commission, adding two more local government representatives, and then the CS before you just adds in separate seismically active regions of the state to accommodate for that recommendation. Section 3 of the work draft defines seismic hazard. There was a concern at the last hearing that if we started to list out tsunami, were we then excluding other geological conditions? And then Section 4 extends the commission until 2012. After conferring with the legislative auditor, 2012 has zero boards and commissions up for termination that year. So that was the year that we chose to add in there. There was one other suggestion that was brought to us today by the department, I believe, that on line 12, page 2, after earthquake, we would insert a comma, landslide, comma, and then remove undersea, so that one of the real examples we have right now is the eruption of St. Augustine, and this would allow, that's a very valid concern right now, that volcanic eruption could cause a tsunami by landslide or... So those were the changes that
okay. we had. So I think that covers everything that we discussed at the last meeting. And, of course, by taking out or dealing with tsunami the way we have, it deleted a couple of pages of text where that term was being inserted different places. So if we could have a motion on the work draft, Senator Wagner.
I would I would move for adoption of Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 83.
The work draft, is there objection? Seeing none, now we have the suggestion there on page 2, line 12, to insert the word landslide there. So as far as the definition of tsunami, would not speak specifically of an earthquake or undersea volcanic eruption, that it would just be an earthquake, landslide, or volcanic eruption, whether it's undersea or next to the sea, if it causes a large ocean wave. So if I could have a motion, unless there's a discussion on that suggestion.
So moved.
Okay, so Senator Huggins has moved then on line 2, or page 2, line 12, afterward earthquake, insert comma, landslide, comma. Without objection, then that will be amendment number 1 that will be adopted. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Heather, on page 2, line 28, the reappointment phrase there, it says, may be reappointed by the governor for a term in B of this section. Does that mean that the governor can only reappoint once, or that you can only serve two terms?
Senator Elton, I don't think so. I think that's just providing that when June 30th, 2006 arrives, the governor may reappoint a member under, because if you go back to Section 1, it's line 6, the terms still remain at 3 years, but this just provides for that transition.
Senator, so I think your question is hinged on the word A, Does it mean single? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm just somewhat concerned that it may be constrictive and that a person who maybe should serve, especially if they got a two-year term and then a four-year term, would be precluded from another term because of the A term.
Yeah, I don't think it's intended to. I don't think it is limiting in its actual operation. We can certainly check with the drafter, though.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking in the statute, and this is just a question for the committee. The statute now provides that six members of a nine-member commission constitutes a quorum. And I don't know, with House Bill 83, with us extending the commission with two more members from the local government, I don't know if six is still a good number for a quorum, or it's just something I noticed.
Mm-hmm. So six would be still
maybe
the majority.
Could comment or
okay. Do we have somebody here for the speak for the department?
Mr. Chairman, I like a quorum of one. That way more people attend the meetings generally.
Hi, for the record, my name is Melanie Lesh. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'm just by way of introducing John Aho, who is on the board, the Seismic Commission board, and he may be able to speak to that.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Aho, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And did you hear the question with regards to what would constitute a quorum?
Yes, I did. I mean, I wouldn't have any problem with a majority constituting a quorum, and six members out of 11 would be a majority.
Okay, so before it was six of nine, so it was actually a bit of a supermajority.
Exactly.
Do you see any reason or has it proved problematic so far?
No, actually, we've had essentially 100% involvement at the three meetings we've had. So
okay,
that hasn't been a problem to date.
Well, unless somebody else on the committee feels otherwise, I feel comfortable with retaining the six. It is, you know, majority still of the new membership. Okay. Don't think that anything we have done triggers a change in the fiscal notes, but the bill does go on to finance, so they will be able to scrutinize that. So is there any further discussion on the legislation? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Committee substitute for House Bill number 83 as amended.
And with the attached fiscal notes.
Attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the bill will be moved from committee. Thank you. That completes our agenda for today.